Feral Audio.
You guys, it's time for another Minor Revelations with Drew Drogi. This is episode 14, I believe, and this week I'm turning 40 years old. Isn't that insane? Not really. We all age and we all grow up and do other things. And I've, in a lot of ways, felt 40 forever. And in other ways, I can't believe that I'm 40. I mean, that's such a like man's age, and I don't feel like a grown man at all. So it's very strange. But I've always really enjoyed getting older in the sense that I feel like I'm more me than I've ever been, and things have gotten better. So, you know, I've had a lot of people ask me like, oh God, is this really hard for you to turn 40? And, it's been great. I mean, I actually haven't turned 40 yet, so maybe on Thursday I will totally change. But by the time you hear this, I will be 40 years old. But every phase of life has gotten better. And, something that my parents always said, that it always gets better every, you know, and it's really been true. I mean, yeah, like things hurt. You don't look as cute or whatever sometimes, and hair is going and things like that. Sure. Okay, fine. Yes. But, I'm very grateful to be 40 years old and getting to do what I do, with my life and having the life that I have, that I haven't had for a long time, that my 20s were really rough. And I think about like, you know, every birthday I do think about like moving to LA when I was 22. And how I just did so many of the wrong things. Those first 10 years of LA and your like 20s to early 30s were murder. And I'm so grateful for them because they paved the way, obviously, to what I get to do now. The only good thing I did was take improv classes at the Groundlings and meet those people there. Because other than that, I mean, when I moved out to LA, I was spending crazy amounts of money on my first apartment in 1999. I don't remember how much, but I had a roommate, a friend from college. We had a place together. We were living in Santa Monica in like a total garbage hole and spending like insane amounts of money. Almost what I spend now for rent. So, and I had nothing, going out to it. I was working at Pottery Barn, which was a job that I got after like 2 months of unemployment. And nothing wrong with that, but if you know anything about me, like I should not be working at any sort of furniture, candle, home improvement space. Like I should just not be there. There are people in the world who should be, who will help people. I was horribly lost there and sort of wandering around and always being written up for holding up a wall, as they would say, because I was always in my head. And, you know, but that's where I first worked when I moved out here. My roommate's friend, my roommate's father was friends with Kevin Costner, and we went to a Kevin Costner premiere, and I thought it was totally appropriate to go up to Kevin Costner's agent and just be like, hi, I'm an actor and I need an agent. To which she was so awesome. Her name was JJ Harris. I don't know if I've talked about her on here or whatever, because she was so incredibly, I mean, I had no idea at the time how incredibly generous she was to take a phone call with me and basically talk to me for an hour on the phone to be like, I am not going to be your agent. I am not what you need. You need to take classes. You need to like calm down. Here's what you need to do. And I think about that now, like I was so bold at that age to think that that's just what I do. Like to go up to a movie star's agent and be like, hey, represent me. I have done nothing and I need your help. So I do think back about like, wow, I was really bold at the time, but I was an idiot about all kinds of things. I had a producer, when I was working at Pottery Barn, a producer came in, and producer in giant finger quotes, like basically like seduced me, like took me out to dinner and did the traditional, like, come back to my place and watch a movie that I made, and tried to like seduce me. And I had no idea that was what was happening. And I look back and I'm like, you idiot. You know, like, this guy is taking you out to dinner. And for what reason? Because you say that you're an actor. Like, I just think about all the things that I did. And the pain and what I didn't know. I spent thousands of dollars in these casting director workshops where you spend money to basically read scenes from Dumb and Dumber to a casting director who maybe hasn't done anything in forever. And some of them are really great. And I do think there is a real value in that. And I did make some relationships in that. But I just think about all of the money that I didn't have that I was spending towards, and really the only good thing that I try to tell people now, like, don't spend your money except in classes and like learning like how to do this versus the business side of this, that you're not even really ready for the business yet. Like, had this agent of Kevin Costner's repped me, I would have had no idea how to handle that or negotiate that. I was like, for a while, like, I thought I was going to, like, because I got trolled by this modeling agency, John Robert Powers, which is this scam organization that's like basically like tells you, a model, you guys, like, I'm not knocking myself. I'm not like a model. I'm not going to be a model. And in my 20s, I didn't know that. I didn't know that I was not a model. I just thought, well, he's like, oh, I look fine. I can do this. So I had this confidence combined with this complete idiot idea of who I was. I would go through Backstage magazine and I would submit for everything I could, and I would audition in people's bedrooms. I would, the projects. I remember one time this guy called me in for like some student film. None of them were ever any pay. Like, you won't get paid. You spend so much money in postage every week and doing this, you know, and I had to go in and read for this. And I was in this guy's bedroom, and he was like, okay, so you're like a victim of a school shooting, and I just want you to just go. And I had to like improvise a dramatic moment that I was, you know, the most horrible thing you can think of. Like, if that was in a movie, like, you'd be like, that's too much. That's too far. No, that I definitely did that. I was cast in a play when I first got here. And there was like a guy that I recognized from commercials. Like, I recognized his face, was directing it. And it was in some crazy theater, and they cast me to play some military general or something. And it was for a comedy, but it was like, I was so horrifically miscast. And I was like, oh, I'm learning characters at the Groundlings. I'll just be this military general in this play. And I remember, like, he also had rehearsals at his house. I wasn't allowed into like proper acting spaces and well until my 30s, like, apparently. But I remember like being in his living room trying really hard to be this real military general. And there was a moment where, like, after two or three rehearsals, where the director just said, I have to go. There's been an emergency. And he left me. It was just the two of us together. He left me in his living room. So I just got in my car, and on the way home, he like called me and fired me from the play and was like, it's just not working out. Cause of course not. So, you know, I was doing like sketch comedy in this strip mall theater by this complete crazy person that was running the whole thing, that named a whole theater company after his last name, and would play mind games and would put us in these horrible sketches that he had written. And we had to like go to his classes and pay for his classes as well to be in his shows. So we were basically paying him so that we could be in his shows, and he would get all the money. And all of that, I was like, well, this is a good opportunity for doing this. Also, like, I, thanks to the Groundlings, like I said, the only good thing that I did, which was a very good thing that I did, you know, I had improv groups that I was with, and I remember there was this one place, and it's no longer around, so I can name it, and it was called the Masker's Cabaret, and it was on 3rd Street. I don't know what it is now. It was like a restaurant, but it was like, I remember it was like for an improv show in like 2000, 2001, so over 15 years ago. Tickets were like $30 to come watch an improv show. So, you know, insanely overpriced food that was just like garbage bag, like barbecue pizza bites, and, you know, overpriced, like bad martinis, probably made with soju, but probably not have real like vodka or gin in them. And so the whole night was like $100 if you wanted to come see a show there. And we would do shows at the Masker's Cabaret, and then we wouldn't have enough people in the audience, and so we would end up paying to be in the show. And I remember thinking again, well, it's worth it. It's a good opportunity. And I remember writing a check for like $100 or maybe, I don't even know how much it was for, to this guy that was running it, who was just ripping us off. And he was on so much coke, and he was just a shyster, like the definition of the word shyster. I mean, and, you know, he ran the Masker's Cabaret. Like, you may as well just call it Ripoff Hut, you know, and all of it was like, it's a good opportunity. And I had a manager at a time who was always getting hammered at all of my shows and was like having my friends drive her home. And like, she also worked out of her apartment, which I guess is fine, but her place was like riddled with trash, and she always had a different animal that she couldn't keep alive. And like, she one time like called me and was like, can I bring my dog to your show? And she's like, she's very quiet, but I have to have my dog with me at all times. And this is who was like representing me. And so, you know, and on like a personal level, my friends were just full of drama, and there were just so many people that were like, I just thought like, oh, they're a difficult person, I guess I should get to know them. And, you know, and my 30s were all about like getting rid of all those people in my life. I don't have friends that like treat me like that, or each other like that. And there's so much less drama. For all the stuff I gripe and complain about, like, I am so much happier now. So, I am very grateful to have made it out of all of that. And I will say, without irony, it gets better. So far, this very first week of being 40 is wonderful. So thank you, 20s and 30s. It's been real. Hi guys, how are you?
Hi.
Hi. I'm here with Guy Branum and Georgia Hardstark. How are you both?
It's beautiful to be here.
Isn't it?
Carpeted music stands are always good to have around.
It's nice. We all have a carpeted music stand next to us that we can rub ever so gently. It's comforting. It's tactile. It's great. It's what, Monday afternoon? Is that what it is?
It's
Monday that we're doing this.
Dreary Monday.
It's a very dreary Monday. It's a very cold Los Angeles afternoon. What's going on? What are we were talking about JetBlue earlier, and I will say it is my, and I'm not sponsored by JetBlue.
No.
None of us are, but it is my favorite airline to fly. You brought it up, and I just wanted to say that if I have to pick an airline, I like it more than Virgin.
Yeah, is Virgin number two?
Virgin is number two. I do love flying Virgin. I love the purple lighting.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I love that it's like, I feel like I'm in a spaceship.
Totally.
But if I have to watch that goddamn Todrick Hall, you know, who else, some safety tips?
Oh my God, no,
one
no,
more
no.
fucking time, I'm going to lose my mind.
Oh my God, Drew Drogi, can't you be supportive of other gay performers?
No, I can't, and I won't. Oh, don't tell me you're gay, Guy. I can't handle it. I won't. It makes me crazy. It is just the definition of medium that makes me want to, I hate it so much.
Here's my deep question about, well, you raised a lot of issues with that last sentence there, and I'm excited about all of them. The question that always gets to me about Todrick Hall is, where's that costume budget coming from?
Like, it's insane, right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's really impressive. But like the medium of it all, there is the weird, fascinating thing mm-hmm. about however distinguishing gay guys are, there is a way that we're just, the vast majority of us just want medium and anything that is a little too much or not.
I know.
Like that we
call, it's what I'm railing against creatively all
that,
my life.
That we
you
still
know,
call
truly.
Big gay is like, yep. Oh my God.
I know.
Baby doll, you should.
I know. I know. And like, I don't know. And it's like, I understand the whole thing about like, we're never going to be happy either. Cause it's like, what do we want? But it's like, I don't want that. I don't want like a nun who's like contortion. Like, I don't know. It's just the whole thing about that video is just, it makes me angry. And the whole, the airline, the whole aesthetic of like everyone on the flight attendants are so familiar that I'm like, if something were to go wrong, I'm with these like, I mean, there was one flight and always the flight from San Francisco to LA is really bumpy because it's always, no matter how you, what you fly, it is because it's low to the ground in the air and going up the West Coast, it's always bumpy. But I was in one flight and the flight attendant was like, my name's Charlie, but you guys can call me Chocolate Chip.
Oh.
And I'm like, no, I don't want to call you Chocolate Chip. And we're like falling through the sky. And I want to like know that like you could at least make me comforted as right. I plunge into the
or
mountains.
Like whip everyone into shape if shit's going wrong.
Right.
Like
exactly.
Instead of being like friendly, like be kind of a cunt and be like,
exactly.
Someone get the fucking line.
Absolutely.
Right now.
And I feel like Virgin, I mean, I feel like JetBlue on the other hand is like an adult. It feels like the old timey idea of what it like used to be to fly. I feel like I'm treated just a little bit better. There's more leg room. I'm a big person. I like to have the leg room. The snacks are great. And it's just a professional way of flying. Yeah. It's like, it's the closest thing we can get to like British Air, you know, here or something like the equivalent.
Well, as a fat American, on a Virgin flight, you lose like an inch of width in the seats. Hmm. And while it's a lovely, loose experience, like that is just a little, it's annoying.
It is annoying.
You know?
Yeah. And there's just something in it that you feel a little bit, it feels a little plastic.
Yeah.
Whereas like, you know, I'm like, you know.
Unsubstantial.
So I'm glad we agree on that.
We tackled it.
But I would fly either of them over most other airlines. So, you know, I will between the two. It's you know, pretty great. What are you, what else do you guys have going on this week?
You just fucking wrapped your TV show, Guy.
I know. Congratulations, Guy. That's so great.
I just wrapped my TV show and my custody sharing agreement with Georgia involves me handing Karen Kilbierre back to her and saying,
I feel like
you can have her now.
So Karen was on your show.
Yeah. Karen was head writer, co-EP,
great.
And one of the judges.
Fantastic.
So that was neat. Recording a lot of TV in 2 weeks. Now it's over.
How many did you do?
16 episodes.
Jeez,
oh my God. In 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Okay. That's
incredible.
Crazy. It's called, you can even talk, you want to talk about it?
It is called Talk Show the Game Show. It is a game show about how good you are at talk shows. Drew Droege is a former champion of the live show.
I had the most fun live in that show that we did at Nerd Melt that one time. It was so much fun.
Thanks for coming and doing it. You were really good.
Oh my God, are you kidding me? I had a blast. And normally I get very nervous in like competition based anything. I get really like, I just get in my head about it. But there was something about that just, It was perfect. It's a great idea.
It is.
It is very interesting, the experienced improvisers who come to the show and have a very rough time with it, and the people who just sort of like melt into it and mm-hmm. are great.
Hmm. Yeah. I bet it's such a specific skill set. You don't know until you're in it. Yeah. Whether you take to it or not, I'm sure. Now, where will it be? Where can people see it and when? Do you know yet?
It will be on True TV.
Great.
Where the television programs of everyone we know are now.
Yep. Yep.
So that was, you know, the bad part about being on very extended cable is you have to make a lot of TV in a short period of time.
Right. Sure.
But the good
part. But that's the model that everyone is under now. Like, that's the story that everyone does now. And it's why, on the flip side, you can get a lot of great people because people aren't committed for an entire year on one show. They're like, oh, 2 weeks? I'll go do that.
Yeah,
you know.
If you had taken Karen longer, I would have fucking... I would have blown your show up. I would have called fucking True TV and be like, do you know that guy has killed people before? Yeah. Shut it down.
That's great.
Those files were sealed, Georgia. That was part of my agreement.
That's so awesome. And do you have an air date yet? Do you know when?
Oh, April 5th.
Oh, that's fast.
But there is something very weird about living in this world where everybody has to have 9 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it's none of us feel successful unless we're fucking
We have to work constantly.
Yeah.
Because we're all getting paid way less than people used to.
Yeah.
And it used to be that people would do 2 or 3 commercials a year.
Yeah.
And they could buy houses, you know, or people would do a pilot and they'd be good for the year.
Yeah.
Or they would do, and now we're all just one thing after another. You have to work. And part of it, I would rather work harder and do more things than just do one thing a year and live off of that.
Yeah.
But the struggle is you have to hustle for everything.
Yeah.
So there's the panic of like, okay, well, I have this job this week, but next week I have no idea what I'm going to be doing.
I have a problem where like I'm constantly hustling and making up new things to do and I got to and then I remember I'm fucking lazy and I like doing nothing and I like staying home with my cats.
Right.
And
right.
Suddenly I have this full schedule and I'm like, why did I do all of that?
I have a problem where I still think I have to say yes to everything.
Yes.
And I've just gotten better. It's always good at the first of the year for me because I just make myself say, is this worth doing? Or are you going to hate yourself? It's not even like, is it worth it? Like, does every, you know, sign point to no? Maybe I shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really bad.
Yeah.
About,
it's easy to say yes, like, 2 months before, and then right. You get to the day of, and you're like,
oh my God, I know.
Why did I
agree to do this thing? And I'm so, because I think I've, you know, when I talked about this little in my intro just now, like, I mean, I've been out here for almost 18 years, and there was this long stretch of time where I wasn't being asked to do anything. So when people started asking me to do things, I was like, well, I have to do it. I have to say yes. I have to do the thing. So, and I'm always still genuinely touched when people ask me to do things. So I am like, I want to, but there are, you know, you just sometimes have to be like, no, sleep is a good thing.
Yeah.
Playing with your cat's a good thing.
Well, and also being able to focus and give proper attention to
Absolutely.
The stuff that really matters
yeah.
to you.
Yes.
Or the stuff that is like yours, where I am a very responsible employee, but I am not necessarily the most responsible when it comes to like taking care of my own stuff.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
And being able to be like, all right, stop, guy, because because those bad times, it's always those bad times in your head.
Right. Absolutely. And there are times where you're like, I have to write this thing and I need the creative energy. Then there's times you're like, I need to unpack my suitcase and do laundry.
Yeah.
I need to get groceries because yeah. I'm not good with self-care sometimes. And I'll just be like, oh, well, I'll be fine. I have 3 hours free this day. I'll sign up for 12
yeah.
things. No, take...
And it takes so much out of, I mean, I don't want to complain, but be like,
I know.
You know, just to go to one place is like, especially in LA, the traffic
yes,
is so bad that getting anywhere is like, you're adding 2 hours to your
Absolutely.
Life and you're going to get home and be exhausted. I recently told myself and was okay with this is that I'm going to say no to any storytelling shows. Not that I was getting a lot, but
yeah.
I realized I fucking hate it and I'm bad at it. And I'm like, it was such a relief when I was like, no, I don't have to say yes to these.
I'm that way with stand-up shows because I don't do stand-up
right.
and I love, you know, watching great stand-up, but I do storytelling.
Yeah,
so when I get up to do
it,
thank you. But when I get to in an all stand-up show and people go, oh, just come and do whatever, I will show up and the audience is just, it's more like they're just confused
yeah.
by the different energy. And I'm like, oh, I might talk for 3 minutes without getting a laugh and that's okay with me. But is it okay with you? And then sometimes you just walk off going, that felt really
yeah.
not the right vibe to do
yeah.
this in. So yeah, it's hard because you want to be part of it. And I used to do a lot more stand-up shows where I would put a wig on and be a character and I can do that easier. But now I'm like, I don't want to change in a bathroom anymore. I don't want to be like, I've done it way too many times. So
yeah.
I just don't want to do it anymore. I get it.
But I can get into a place where I've cleaned my calendar out so that I can focus on something. And then now I get to this point where I'm done with this show and it's like, oh God, am I even a stand-up anymore? How do I do this? And I know that I have to like grind back at it hard, but I've completely gotten out of the rhythm.
Do you?
But
I'm like, you gotta
terrible.
Do nothing now. You just
yeah.
filmed a fucking TV
you just
show,
did a TV
dude.
Show.
Yeah.
And the other thing too, that the thing that I think we all forget is that like, I would never think of you. I would never be like, oh, I haven't seen Guy on a stand-up show lately. He must not be doing it anymore.
Where's Guy, do you know what I mean? Then?
We think that about ourselves because we're constantly in our own, like, what am I not doing and where have I not been? But the perception is no different.
But there's also the thing of when people get the excuse of mid-level success to not do things.
You're right.
And, like, you see those people and you see how then 4 years later they don't know what they're doing with themselves
right,
anymore.
Right, right, right. Yep.
And it is like, oh, God, I don't want to be, you know, any number of human beings that I have worked for.
Oh, absolutely.
Who, like, are still, like... A former employeress of mine sure was still telling jokes about having roommates when she had had a television program on E for 4 years.
Yep, wow. Yep, absolutely. I know. That's the thing that, you know, you do realize you do step out of it. And yeah, I know. And it's when you have to book those shows, like just showing up and being like, just let me try some new stuff and let me. Well, I think the pressure to fail is so much greater when you're on TV, because you're like, people will. They look at you like, wait, I thought they were funny. And you're like, you know, we're human beings and we're gonna fail. And I always admire the very successful people who will pop in and go, I'm just gonna pop in and do a show tonight and try out new stuff. Because you do have to do that. And it's the balance. I don't think you ever know the right answer to that, but.
Ooh, I fucked up that last storytelling show. I did so hard.
Oh, God.
Like, just fucking blew it.
How did you, though? But you seem like you'd be so great at doing that.
Thank you.
Understand.
I'm not. I just get nervous.
Alone. In front of an audience.
Alone in front of an audience makes me nervous. Not when I'm on stage with someone else, it's fine. But, like, man, I fucked it up. And I was like, I don't have to do this anymore.
My question for Live My Favorite Murders is... Do you, because that's not like a structure or a trope that we know the way that like doing storytelling or stand up is. Mm-hmm. And it's not like you can open mic stories about murder or whatever.
Well, speak for yourself.
How many live shows have you guys done now?
I think we've only done three or we've done like four.
Yeah. And like, basically, what have you learned from them? And are you excited for the tour?
Because I'm learning a lot because I haven't done this. And Karen is really helping me because she's done it for so long. And she's given me some really great tips. Uh-huh. And my husband, Vince, will be there. And he's good at softly giving me tips and advice without telling me that I fucking blew it. But it's really scary being in front of that many people, but they're also so fucking nice that it's exciting.
Well, it is, like, it's such a captivating show to begin with.
I know.
That I've, like, the one live show I went to was really, really good, but it is that thing of, like, figuring out rhythms and energy is just, it's hard.
Well, like, well, I just like
live
Karen.
Podcast in general is so much different from when you're right here with, you know, in this padded room that we're in, you know, when you have people there. The thing that has always helped me, though, and I have to remind myself constantly, is that, like, especially when people are coming to see your live show, they're fans and they want a good show. Mm-hmm. Like, I still live in that space of, like, they're out there judging and they're hating and they're like,
come for me.
It's the opposite. Like, you have to think, like, no, they only want it to be the best show ever. Yeah. They want it to be the most special thing that only they get to experience. So they're willing you to be good, like, you know, as opposed to trying to point out what's not good about what we're doing.
Tell me about Casita del Campo, because it seems on the one hand that, like, those are people showing up for what they know they're showing up for, but also it seems like those are could be catty faggots, you know?
It's both. It's absolutely both. I will say it is my favorite place to perform in L.A.
Yeah.
Because
the amount of cheese they put on top of them.
That queso. Those ethanol margaritas that get people so hospital drunk.
I love that place.
Without fail, I have two or three people every time I do a show there who will email me or text me the next day and go, I am so sorry. I got so drunk at your show. I have no idea.
Hospital drunk is the best idea.
Yeah.
I think I stole that from Edie Patterson, but years ago. She said something about being hospital drunk, and I think it's the greatest. It is because the margaritas are insanely strong. And you go down there, there's a witchy magic that happens in that basement where as a performer, there's such a freedom. Like, I've never once, even, I mean, when we do the Golden Girls down there, We do two episodes word for word, and it is really hard. And we put it together in a couple days, and we throw it together, and it's exhausting. And like, we do costume changes, and it is like I lose my mind. Yet once we walk out on stage, I have zero fear because I'm like, the audience is only there to love this, because we really try to do, we try to be right by that. Our goal is never to fuck up. Our goal is never to be like, well, who cares? But you do have that energy there whereas like from my background with the Groundlings and even at UCB at sometimes, but not so much, but the Groundlings, which is such incredible training, the pressure is so hard. It's because you're being judged every time until you're in that main company. So you're so worried about your material. And if it doesn't go well, it's not just like, oh, the audience didn't laugh at you. It's like, oh, you could get cut for that. Like it could. And so you feel like the stakes are so much higher than they really are. Like, and when I go watch shows at the Groundlings, I'm only there to laugh at them and enjoy them. And I want to enjoy them. But you feel, when you're performing, you feel a real pressure. Whereas a casita, you're just like, who cares? So it's such a relief to go down there. Now, it is also, they have gotten much better. They've recarpeted it down there. But there was a time where I was convinced there was black mold down there. And I was like, I was going to be the Aaron Brockovich of LA Silver Lake Basement Theater, because I was going to be like, I'm whistleblowing this place out, because I would go down. Every one of us would talk about, we would go down there and we would be there for an hour and start coughing uncontrollably.
Oh my God.
Or my voice would go. I would lose my voice. And I'm like, I don't understand what this is. But yeah, it's
I can't help but think of a fire hazard when I go down there. Like, if there was a fire, we'd all die.
Oh, we're done.
The questionable legality of that space is one of the greatest recommendations of it. Like, you feel like you're on the, like, it gives you a little bit of that Lower East Side, like, basement theater feel.
Well, and it's, because I've talked about it a lot on the show, but if you guys who are people listening who don't know what it is, it's a Mexican restaurant in Silver Lake that has a 70-seat basement a 70-seat theater in the basement. That's what I'm trying to say. And I perform there a lot, and it is one of those best kept secrets that, like, you don't really know about until you're really in Silver Lake and people talk about it.
Yeah,
and
Karen,
like,
brought me to my first show there, actually. It's Jackie Beat.
Okay, so you Jackie
so
Beat.
So amazing.
Who, of course, who does all that. And it's one of the few places in LA, if not the only place, maybe the Groundlings is the same way, where people just go and have no idea what they're going to see. You know, they're like, they will go have dinner there and they go, let's just go downstairs and watch whatever's here.
Crab enchiladas.
Okay. You know, oh, I know. Are you kidding? The greatest. So I want to hear some stories or tell me some things. Who wants to?
You want to go first? You want me to go
first?
What sort of things are we supposed to tell you, Drew?
Anything that you just have not really talked about till you want to, like, throw up. Anything.
So my dad died a year ago on the 3rd, and I was in the middle of shooting stuff, and I completely forgot about it. And then I, like, realized that
the anniversary, you forgot about.
Yeah, it was the first anniversary, and the Super Bowl made me realize it. But it was weird because, not unlike a lot of gay guys, my dad was a construction worker. We didn't have a great relationship.
Where was he?
He was in rural Northern California, about an hour north of Sacramento.
Okay.
And he was, like, head of facilities and custodians for a school district, and he went to, like, some sort of training thing in the morning, and he just had a heart attack. And he was, like, 64.
Wow.
And it's the weirdness of, like, there are ways that my relationship is better with him now than...
I get that completely. I mean, not to turn this all around to my story, but I also lost my dad in January, 13 years ago.
Uh-huh.
We were really close, but it was, yes, my memory of it, it's like I only remember all the great stuff, and, like, in a way, and, like, have, and then this year, because I was also really busy, on January 14th is our anniversary of his death. And it's usually, I usually wake up thinking about it. Like, it just hits me and I go, oh, it's January 14th. But this year I've been so busy and I forgot. And I got a text from my brother who texted my mom and me. And it's been 13 years. So it used to be like, it's one of those anniversaries that is still weird, and you know, but it does get a lot less. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's his birthday is always a bigger deal than this.
The first one must be hard though, especially if you're like skipped it.
Yeah, right.
I
wonder if that's like something and you're like protecting you from, because it's like, I don't know.
Or like if he knew you were doing, you forgot because you were filming your fucking own TV show.
I know.
I think he'd be proud.
He wouldn't be proud that I had a TV show. He would be proud that I was working so hard I forgot emotional things.
That's so funny.
Then it was supposed to happen. Then that's how you honored him.
Yes. Yes. But isn't it, did you have parents that were like, that valued hard work over anything else?
Yeah. And that is like, because they were both sort of like working class people and didn't really understand a lot of the things that I was into, it's so easy for me to see these kids with like city parents who understand what they do, or like who went to NYU and got a nice screenwriting degree, and be like, oh, them. But it's only within the past year really that I've, and it was not long before he died, and I did say it to him, I realized like the extent to which my parents sort of like drilled me on hard work.
Yes.
Has been such a benefit to me.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Same here. Like I go through these periods where I get really irritated when my mom, because every time now I'll call with good news, my mom's response is usually like, well, good. You've been working so hard. You deserve it. And I'm like, God, just say you're so good. You know, I want them to say you're so talented. And that's the part of the thing that, but to my mom, the hard work is way more of like the accomplishment, is that I've worked so hard. And I think too, like, you know, we have this weird relationship with hard work because creatively it's like, don't work so hard. Don't try so much. That thing where we all know people in this business that have just that only work hard, that aren't talented.
Right.
You know, and we go, ugh, they're working so hard. They're trying too much. Give it up. Do something else that, you know, follow, you know. And so I've developed this like lack of respect for hard work, which I don't think is right. I mean, I think it's good. I mean, I agree with you. It's like, I think hard work is so, so commendable. And it's something that people who grow up with a lot of money or connections or an ease into it, are almost done no favors in that way, because they are not told to work hard. They are not, and they are just told like, oh, we'll just call our friend and get on a show.
Or have an example of what working hard can get you.
Exactly.
Or not get, you know, not working hard can get you.
And there's the weird difference between hard work and hard hustle, because there are so many, like, especially millennials who come into comedy world and are like pure hustle.
Yeah.
And like, you respect that because it's a little bit like, God, if I had been more like that when I was 28, what would have happened?
They work their fucking asses off. I mean, maybe you don't like what they do.
Yeah.
Those usually aren't the kids who are hitting every open mic and doing everything they can to get really good at what they do.
Well, they think about it's something that, and I'm going to botch the quote, but Steve Martin was quoted at somewhere, was talking about people. He was saying that people ask him, How do you make it? How do you do it? What's advice? What advice do you have? And he was like, the answer that I give is never the one that people want to hear.
Yeah.
They want to hear, here's how you get an agent. Here's how you get seen. Here's do A, B, and C, and then D will happen. And he's like, the reality is just be so good that they have to hire you.
Right.
That you are the one that they have to. And he's like, people don't want to hear that because they want to think, it's about like the mechanics of doing this thing, doing this thing, doing this thing. And all of those things are equally important. And you can't just be like talented on a cloud somewhere, like waiting for someone to come find you. You do have to do it. But I do think too, like making your, I mean, making your own stuff and getting it out there is the most important thing. And then worrying about like who sees it and when is less important, like, as that happens on its own and it happens differently for different people at different times. And some people hit when they're, you know, 20 years old and right out of school, and some people hit when they're in their, you know, late 60s and that's their thing or whatever. Like, it doesn't, like, there's no formula.
The amazing thing about My Favorite Murder is that the two of you were very experienced performers who had like worked in a bunch of stuff, and you just like started this thing because you liked it and you loved it, and then the response was like immediate and overwhelming.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the thing of like, you never know what it's going to be.
Right.
You never, you like really the first, don't. The reason I got into any kind of performing in, you know, this industry is because my friend and I, Allie Ward, we made a chicken McNuggetini cocktail video, and then it was like Food Network was like, can you do this? Like, so I was already like, you could do fucking any, and I'll just do like, I had like a vintage dress thing, and I had a blog, and I just was like constantly trying to get something going, and then we did My Favorite Murder, and that fucking hit, and it's like, who the
fuck? All of it builds up, and you can look back and go, oh, that was all part of a great plan, but I don't even know what that plan is when I'm in the middle of it, you know? And that's the thing about like, about just staying in it, like endurance and like still going, as opposed to just like thinking the opposite way of going, okay, this will be my thing.
Yeah.
Cause it comes from a different place. I mean, when you were putting together Talk Show, the game show live on stage, you weren't thinking, okay, this will be what I'll sell to TV and this will be my own show. You're like, no, this is an idea that I have that's going to fill a really great creative space. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And that's what people respond to.
Like, because I'm assuming that you, not unlike me, get a fair number of little gay boys being like, can I have coffee with you and talk to you about how comedy works?
Absolutely.
And then what they want to hear is, as you were saying, path to being famous. And the thing of like, enjoy being good. Enjoy the things that you do.
Absolutely.
Feels like a non-answer when some kid from Ohio is like, but how do I pay my rent with that? Mm. But it really is the only feedback loop.
It's the only thing you can really, and I always feel like sometimes when I do have coffee with some of these people, that I am just stealing a cup of coffee from them, because, you know, I'm like, I don't really know what to say. And the longer I've been doing it, the less I know sometimes. Yeah. I'm like, I think 10 years ago, I would have given you a better plan than I even know now. But I do think it's like, you know, you look back and you're like, I used to, when people would say that to me, there was part of me going, there's something you're not telling me. And I'm like, no, it's really not that. It is, you know, you have to be willing to be poor for a long time and maybe have a hard time paying your rent for a while.
And have a day job. Hate.
Don't be an idiot.
And make a fool of yourself. Periodically have ideas that don't work.
Right?
Or that three people show up for.
Yep. Yeah. And, you know, because you truly have no idea how, you know, everything that I have had success with, I think about, like, how did that start? And I'm like, oh, it was just this crazy idea I had that I tried. I had 100 others that didn't hit.
Yeah.
I can't tell you what of mine, I didn't know when, it was just an idea at the time. But if I didn't do them because I didn't think they were valid or worth it, I would never have done them.
Yeah.
So.
It's true.
Yeah. And it's hard because in other professions and other worlds, there is a much clearer path in telling people how to do this. And I would tell you, like, you know, you have to do, you know. And then the other thing I always say to people is, like, learn how to do it. Go to school. Go to class.
Yeah.
You know, there are always the people that are like, you know, Diane Weiss, to bring him up again, like, I think we were talking about her before we started recording, but she's never had an acting class. Well, that's amazing. And that is a unicorn inside of a shamrock. But most people, like, learn how to do this. Go to school.
It is fascinating working on sitcoms where there are these people like who are on this path to being writers, like writers' assistants and script coordinators and stuff, who are on this path to like getting to sit down at a table and then have to pitch jokes, who are doing nothing of what they are doing professionally is preparing them to pitch jokes. And I see these because I work on a show where those people are girls, because I always end up working on girl shows. Mm-hmm. And it is like this thing of like, there's a ticking clock here, like where like you need to be in UCB or Groundlings classes so bad right now.
Yes.
Because you, like, there's going to come a point in time when you get to sit down at that table. And if you can't do it, you'll get pushed out of the system.
Absolutely.
And the amount of people you make connections with at those classes
absolutely.
Are huge. That's who you're going to end up working yeah. with, because the two of you connect and make a fucking thing.
And learning how to collaborate
yeah.
and learning, I mean, and truly learning like how a group works
yeah.
versus just like what you come up with on your own. Great. But how can you take somebody else's idea and
add to it
and, you know.
But as a stand-up, the thing that always horrifies me about your improv world is that there is this council of people who decide your fate.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be playing politics with them, where stand-up is so much looser. And it is a world where
yes.
you don't have classes, which makes it kind of harder for women and anyone who is not like a straight dude.
Yes.
That because it's more subtle social games. But mm-hmm. it is always a thing of like, if one scene doesn't like you, you can go to another. And I always fear that about
right
improv.
Right well, and I think like the lesson in that is like as somebody who has gone through and done in a bunch of those circles, you know, it's like finding your church, for lack of a better way of saying it. And you're like, you'll find your group of people, you know, if you love it, and it, you know, and it genuinely, like, the problem is that the people who go to one place and their style is just so different from mm-hmm. that what that place is about. And as someone who teaches at the Groundlings, I have students and I say to them, I'm not giving you lip service. You need to go to UCB, because I actually also work at UCB, and your style would be so much better suited at UCB. You could be the funniest person in the room, and you're going to get up and bang heads against that. But the weird thing is that, like, the last thing people want is to see you playing the politics. So you actually, you're better off like them not knowing who you are at all and just showing up on stage and doing your work than the person who goes to all the parties mm-hmm. and hangs out after all the shows, because that person has the hardest time because they've created a weird social idea of who they are. And it just is, as people are, they're like, oh, that person's at all the shows. Now, if they're also really funny or people really like them, it's great. But if they're like figuring out who they are, or they're just an oddness there, like, you're better off not doing anything. But I do think, like, in the stand-up world, there are those stand-up comics that everybody just loves having on their shows. And then there are those people that people are like, never, right? Yeah. I mean, it's the same in that way. But I know it is so creepy how much of a popularity contest it can feel like sometimes. But then at the same time, I don't know. I mean, I just know, like, how at the Groundlings there's a lot when people, it's noted when people, it's like when someone's like around too much. It's
yeah.
like, because the assumption is, and I don't even say we, because I'm not in the main company of the Groundlings, but the assumption is that person is maybe not good, and they might be wonderful, but if they don't know their work, if you only know them socially first, you're yeah. like, oh, they're trying to work a different angle. They're about everything but the work.
Right.
And that shoots talented people in the foot who think they need to play that game.
Right.
You know, like the people that you're like, they're actually really good. And I try to say to people, like, you don't maybe need to hang out all the time just so that, you know, and because there are so many communities now in the sketch world, it's a very different vibe mm-hmm. at all of the places than it used to be, because there's no longer that weird sense of like, oh, the Groundlings are the keepers of the kingdom, where it used to be that way. When I moved out here 18 years ago, like, that's where you are in LA, that's where you would yeah. do sketch and improv. And now there are so many places, and it's much healthier, I think, now that there's so much more.
Yeah, there's like a sect for everyone, every type
right.
of person.
Exactly, exactly. Georgia, what do you want to...
Okay, you guys want to hear nipple piercing or pot rice crispy Disneyland?
Those both sound great. I will say we've had a lot of
pot.
Drug stories.
Yeah, okay.
And so I'm going to say nipple piercing.
Yes.
Okay. When I was 16 years old, I took my mom's car for the first time driving alone.
And she knew you were taking it?
Yeah, it was
okay.
Fine. I drove from Orange County to Los Angeles by myself, and I went to the UCLA Book Festival.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I went was, yeah, was to meet Ray Bradbury.
Oh, wow.
Sci-fi writer.
Whoa.
So I had been on drugs a lot before that period and kind of got off of them with his help because I was so obsessed with his books. I just stopped wanting to go out and hanging out. And I was obsessed with his books. And it kind of, I think it saved my life in a lot of ways. And so I was going, he was going to be there, you know, lecturing. And I was just like, I have to go to this. I have to go meet him and thank him. Mm-hmm. So I get to the hall where he's speaking. The guy at the door is like, sorry, it's full. You can't come in. And I was just like, 16-year-old Georgia was like, my mom's in there and she has my purse. Can I just go get it from her? He was like, yeah. And I just fucking ran in and got a seat. And then he, you know, 2 hours of a lecture. It was amazing. It was, my whole mind was blown. And then afterwards, I went on stage when he was being interviewed, and I just handed him a letter, and it was like a 3-page letter of like how he helped me.
Oh my God.
And then afterwards, I was so buzzing and so high and so happy. Not high, but, yeah, you know, that I drove to Melrose Avenue and told a piercer that I was 18 and got my nipple pierced to commemorate the day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And how long, do you still have it pierced?
No, I took them out a long time ago.
Okay.
I
was going to assume that you didn't, but how long did you have it? How did you have it pierced?
I had it pierced for a few years. I mean, it was cute. I have tiny tits. And so it was just like this cute little thing. But I know I'm an adult now and I would never...
Yeah.
That.
I would think that at a certain point. Did you have any like issues with it? Was it ever, or was it only just a.
No, it was fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The idea of an infected nipple is just very disturbing.
It's terrifying.
No.
So why that? Why not a tattoo?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I had a homemade tattoo, but I think I had wanted to get my nipple pierced anyway. No, I think it was a last minute thought. I don't know. It's just like, I just had this sudden idea to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hidden so my mom wouldn't see it, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, and also that's this like sort of milestone, right?
Yeah.
Like just to get to. And what was your tattoo of?
My best friend and I, when we were 14, carved each other's initials in our legs with like a prison tattoo style.
Oh my God.
I know. I was a real
shit
kid. That was when I was on drugs. And then 2 weeks later, Ray Bradbury sent me a care package.
Oh, that's lovely.
That was like, because I told him
awesome.
I want to be a writer, and it just, he sent me like Zen and the Art of Writing with like, Onward Georgia was his like personalization. I mean, it was like, it was gorgeous.
Oh my God, that is so great.
Yeah.
And what of his writings is your favorite?
I mean, I love Martian Chronicles so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so perfectly written. I mean, I guess Fahrenheit 451 is a little timely.
Right, of course. I know.
Yeah.
Scarily so.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever read any of his books. I remember reading a lot of his short stories.
Yeah.
And seeing him on so many things. Like, he was always, like, on TV.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Wasn't he always on, like, sci-fi shows and stuff? And so I was like, he was always kind of around.
He would tell his own stories and write stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Fahrenheit 451 was always a thing that people would do monologues from.
Oh,
like,
really?
In like high school like drama competitions, people would always do. I don't remember what it was, but I would be like, this is from Fahrenheit 451. And you're like, oh God, this again, like getting botched.
Oh,
because
God.
I think people were like, this is, you know, important. And so how long were you into the drugs and stuff in the
just a couple year, mm-hmm. like from 13, and then I was in rehab.
Oh wow, so you really were into it. Okay.
So how does a 13-year-old get exposed to these things? How does it begin?
Yeah.
I think it's just having no parental supervision, not fitting in and wanting to find something else to identify themselves with, you know, and just falling in with the bad crowd.
And being 13, I mean, like, I think that's like so young to think about, like, when you're doing that stuff, you're not at all thinking beyond.
No, it's crazy. And like, I'm a pretty normal person now. And I think most people wouldn't assume that of me. And I just can't believe I got out clean. Right. I got out unscathed.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people go through those periods and go through those things. But I mean, to go all the way through to the rehab stage, that's pretty, that's major.
And
that's really great. And why Ray Bradbury? I mean, other than, you know.
I just always loved sci-fi. Well, actually, no. One of my teachers in eighth grade, I think she knew I wasn't doing well, like kind of fucked up. Uh-huh. And she handed me, and I always loved reading, and she handed me a book by Ray Bradbury and was like, I think you'll like this. Like, on the down low.
Oh, that's so cool.
And I did, and I just like changed my fucking life.
Yeah.
Mrs. Taylor, thank you.
Yeah.
She was an English teacher.
Isn't it just great? I mean, school is such an important thing to me. Like, I was the opposite. Like, I was Mr. Overachiever, and I was such a good kid.
Yeah.
I mean, read The Velvet Rage. Like, I was that one.
Yes.
I mean, I was, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to, this is something I can be really good at, and I'm going to prove you all that I'm a good person, and I'm not going to deal with, you know, my sexuality at all. And, you know, and so I lived and died by my teachers, and the teachers that I hated so much.
Yeah.
I had so much more drama in my life at school than I had at home, really, in that way. But, and the teachers that got me and saw things in me, and I'm sure there was part of it too that, like you were saying, it was on the down low when she handed you this book.
Yeah.
There's a thing about, like, I see you.
Yeah.
In a really cool way that you're like, I don't feel like anybody else really sees me.
Yeah.
Because I had family that always loved me, but there was so much with me that were like, we don't know what he's doing up there. We don't know what he's reading. We don't know what he's into. And when I had those teachers that were like, you know, you need to read this.
Yeah, or see, so you're struggling somehow. Or
right. Or just being like, I know who you are, and I think you would really, you know.
Yeah, special.
Embrace that.
Drew, what was the texture of the teachers who hated you?
I think that I had the teachers who were... who were almost threatened by, because I would act out a lot, and it was a big deal to me to make people laugh at school, because I did not make my family laugh, and to this day they kind of look at me like, what?
Yeah.
And so, but I could make my, and it was my deflector from being bullied, that I could always make people laugh. And so I would, and I had this group of really strong friends from like junior high through high school. And so the teachers who were threatened by my sense of humor would be really cruel in a way of like, I had a teacher one time send me to the principal's office to get like post-its for her, like on an errand. And while I was gone, she was like, so what's wrong with Drew? To the class. With all of my friends in there.
Oh, my God.
And, like, what's really going on there? She's like, and I think it was, like, she felt threatened. Like, her authority was threatened. Like, I sort of took over the room.
Wow.
When I was in the room. You know, and things like that. And, of course, I found out immediately. Because, I mean, my friends couldn't wait to tell me. They were like, what is that about?
My mom, you know, was ridiculous. Tore her up. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it was there was always a sense of, and there was in seventh grade, I had a teacher who, we went to the same church in small town, North Carolina. And she was the wacky eccentric. She taught language arts, and everybody's like thought that we would
language
be
language arts.
I know, like, not, yeah, don't call it English or reading, you know, language arts, like so magical. And everybody thought that she and I would fit, like it would be this glove fit situation. And it was the opposite, because she was an idiot, and there was no teaching happening. She would just kind of, it was all fluff. And I saw it, and I was in seventh grade, which was my Welcome to the Dollhouse year, where I would measure my good and bad days. I would get home and go, okay, I wasn't called a fag today. Oh, so that was a good day. That was my barometer. Was I called a fag today? And that's
it. Wow.
And I was never beat up. It was never anything physical. It was all verbal, but it was really hard that year. And I had her that year, and I would go into her class, and it would just be bullshit hour with her. So I would put my head down on my desk and just like either sleep or just try to pretend to not be there, because we didn't have to do any work for her. And at church one day, she told my mom that she thought I was on drugs. And I was like the good kid who had never seen drugs, let alone, you know. And I remember, like, for like a month, like my mom and dad told me later that like they were like checking me out and like really worried and like, you know. And they just realized, like, no, this woman is an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And she's using, and she's at church, like, totally going outside of, you know, and being like, you know, I think this is what's going on with Drew. And I was like, no, I'm just smelling your bullshit, and you don't know how to handle it.
Yeah.
you know, and yeah. So I mean, there were quite a few teachers that would, you know, that yeah. And then in the same year, I would go like the next period, I could go into another teacher's classroom and do everything I could to have them love me, and I would go above and beyond because I wanted, you know, to learn. Like I was that, you know.
What flavor of Jesus-y were you raised?
Presbyterian.
Okay.
So very mild.
That's chill, right?
Very chill.
Yeah. For North Carolina, sure.
For North Carolina, yeah. Yes. It was not... I have to say that to this day, I don't have... I have a lot of hang-ups about church because of things like that, because of the horrible people that call themselves Christians, but I have very little hang-ups about Jesus and Christianity itself. Hmm. Like, I don't have problems with it at all. There was a lot of people who were raised a lot more extreme. Do.
Here's the thing that fascinates me about being called faggot in grade school is your peer group is just trying to label a thing
right.
that they've been taught by popular culture and you are.
Right.
And the entire problem is just your parents telling you, well, if you stopped acting like that, they wouldn't do this. Or right. teachers being like, we had this amazing conversation in my fourth grade class where Mrs. Sanger told everyone that they needed to stop making fun of me for being fat. And I was like, they never really said anything about that. Like,
Oh my God.
Like, it was.
Wow.
But we like couldn't, you like, you know, in the mid 80s in rural Northern California, that never could have been a conversation. And it is just, I mean, it's just.
Well, and it's also so, it's so crazy because you don't even think, like, I'm like, in seventh grade, I'm like, I didn't even think I was gay. It was, yeah. I was like, I had no idea what that even was. And it wasn't like you were doing anything. Uh-huh. Like, it was like, you're effeminate. And that's different from how, and again, everybody's getting something in yeah. that, you know. And it is like what Welcome to the Dollhouse taps into so brilliantly. And those things that, you know, we're like, everyone is, it's just a terrible time.
Ugh, it's the worst.
But there are things that some people outgrow and there are things that there's an essence in you that other people see before you see in yourself. And you're trying to figure out who you are yeah. and you're going through puberty or not. I wasn't. I was such a late bloomer. I didn't start till a couple of years after that. So I had no idea why I was being attacked like that.
Well,
you
kids,
know,
I don't know if it's the same today because they have all those bullying rules, but it's like any little thing that you're different, that is different about you and these fucking assholes, maybe it's just the 80s that mm-hmm. like would attack you for. Mm-hmm. And if you're not a confident person or if you don't think you're good either, you know, you'll just go with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that happened to me. I think that happens to a lot of people where it's yeah. just like, you know,
well, you normalize it
yeah.
really quickly because it just becomes like, because I think back to that and I'm like, at the time, I mean, it sounds so tragic, that year in my life. But at the time, it was just, that's life. That's yeah. how it is. And then for me, eighth grade, I became really popular. And I was popular all through high school. And so it was like, for me, I'm lucky that it was only 1 year yeah. that I really felt so much of that, like, sort of pressure. Because people, it was partly because I was funny and partly because, you know, I've said this before on the show that I convinced people that I was possessed by the devil because that's how you get people scared of you.
What does that mean?
I pretended to have this evil being inside of me.
Oh my God.
And I would pretend to be possessed. And my friends thought it was hilarious. It might be to this day. I've got a bunch of gay demons running through my skin. But I used to pretend because I would make my friends laugh, but there would be people that were genuinely scared of it because they believe in that stuff. And you realize, like, when people believe in, like, Satan worship, oh, you can get away with so much fun stuff.
I love it.
Because you just act like, you know, you're the devil. And they're like, oh, we got to get away from that because he could jump into me.
Oh, my God.
You know? And I just realized that on a... You know, and that was my saving grace.
I think drugs were a little bit like that for me because I was picked on a lot. And then it was like, oh, she's bad. Like, I became bad. You know, I would do bad things and I would do drugs. And I think it was and hang out with like bad people.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was just like, leave me alone.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be this bad person
uh-huh.
just so you'll stop fucking picking on me.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that crazy what we like self-harm
yeah.
to just to get people to leave you alone? It's yeah. just a certain it's really crazy. But I'm also grateful for it to this day because, oh, my God, people who've never been picked on or ostracized are pathetic when
imagine
I get
being happy.
Imagine
so
being happy.
You have no horror
I don't
stories?
Understand it. I just don't get it.
When I meet people whose parents are normal or even still married, I'm like, oh my God, what is that?
What
like?
Is that? What? Tell me about that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you get people that, you know, or they, that's when people fall apart in their 20s or even later, maybe because yeah. they've had nothing bad happen to them and then something yeah.
right.
goes wrong and they just can't.
I'm almost glad
deal
I did drugs
it.
That young because all my friends in their 20s started doing coke and shit. And I was like, I'm good. I don't
that's,
need
yeah,
it.
That's my brother. My brother was very experimental in his early teens. That's, and now yeah. he's like, the most, he would be like, no way would he get yeah. involved in it. And he's like, sells insurance now. So it's like, you know, that's the thing that, you know, you get over that at a certain point. For me, even when I went to college, everybody was like smoking pot for the first time. And I had already been busted for smoking pot. Like, and I was already in the newspaper for smoking pot. So I was like, we're good. Yeah. I don't, you know, I'm good on that. So anyway,
yeah.
well, I think we're out of time. On that note. Isn't that a wonderful way to end? Well, and
that was wonderful. I thought we were just getting going.
I know.
And we're like, we're ready. I know. Well, we can, you know, pick it up where we left off next time, I guess.
It's delightful.
Delightful. You guys are both
you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having
for
me.
For giving up your money. For driving across town to, you know, to
no,
lush and gorgeous Burbank. Okay. I want to thank my guests, Georgia Hardstark and Guy Branum, for being on the show this week.
Thank you.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
Have a great week.
Bye.
Feral Audio.